Welcome to the Resource People Podcast, presented to you by Australian Resources and Energy Group, AMA. The Resource People Podcast brings to life the stories behind the people, workforces and companies of our great industry.
Welcome to Resource People Podcast. I'm Tara Diamond from AMA, your host, and it's wonderful to bring you a conversation with Byron Davis from Ventia. Byron was recently crowned the winner of the Future Leader category in the 2021 AMA Industry Awards for his role as a Deputy Project Manager and his important contribution to the company's dedicated Indigenous employment team, Trekker. I'm sure you'll be moved and inspired by Byron's candid description of his background and the reasons for his drive in advocating for Indigenous employment. Hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to Resource People Podcast, Byron.
Thanks, Tara.
Well, firstly, congratulations on winning the Future Leader category of the 2021 AMA Industry Awards.
Thank you very much. Yes.
And I'd love to get started with you telling us about your career and your background and what you do at Ventia.
Yeah, no worries. A little bit about myself, Kalkadoon, Wanyu, first and foremost. That's being my Indigenous culture, where my heritage is, where I've grown up. And Kalkadoon Wanyu, for those that don't know, is in the Mount Isa region, Kalkadoon being part of the Mount Isa area, and the Wanyu being up near Lawn Hill, near Dumaji.
Wow, so great.
Long ancestry has come from. Fierce warriors, the Kalkadoon people of Queensland, come from a strong generation of warriors in the space that I work in.
That's awesome. And what about what you do at Ventia?
So where I've grown up in Mount Isa, is that I've come from a very cowboy northwest Queensland in the remote sticks, grew up in the 1970s and 80s, a very strong how you're supposed to be behaving and how you're supposed to conform to society. I grew up, went to a school where I was told where to sit. I went to the cinema and told where to sit on the left-hand side of the cinema. So this has all happened in my time, in my age. So one of my biggest advocates for coming into the roles that I've got at today has been people like my mother, who was a massive advocate. She's kind of a beacon for my mob in Mount Isa in the early 80s. She ran for a local member. As a local member, one of the first kind of Indigenous females that would have actually ran in the early 80s.
Wow.
So it was a powerful time. And I always seen a lot of my mother spending a lot of time connecting with people, supporting them, helping our mob feed, food, clothing. A lot of things that I grew up with, my age, I was still seeing the reserve systems living, you know, across the road from me. So it was my mother that actually made sure that no one suffered, you could say. And I guess that's where I've come from, and, you know, thinking about where I've got this, been instilled this feeling of helping Indigenous Australians' human rights. I was kind of sucked into the system later and as a child because I was told and dictated what to do and where to go. Because of who I was and who I was connected to in Mount Isa and the colour of my skin, I wasn't able to participate in certain things like birthdays and like everyone else could, because they were all in non-Indigenous families that were there. So having a coloured fella there was going to be a little bit awkward. We weren't able to ride our bikes up the road, things like that, because we actually feared that as children we weren't allowed to, because we were told by neighbours up the road, don't you ride up the road, this is not your street. So things like that that just dictated to us. And I always said, who's advocating for me? Who's advocating for my circumstances? That's what I later felt. Who actually did that for me? You know, when I was through that type of those behaviours that I dealt with. And so coming into a place like Ventia, into the Trekker team, where a lot of my life has been in advocating basic human rights for Indigenous Australians through our workplace and through employment and recruitment, there is someone there advocating. There's someone there that's working to make sure that this gap, this massive gap of what's happened in the past, we're actually sharing and training and helping people. There is a massive gap out there in our work sites, in our workplaces, you know, and it's been created through history. It can be quite uncomfortable, and I'll say that to the audience now, that some of the stuff that I deal with can make people very uncomfortable, because it's about accepting that we first do have a problem. You know, we start talking about keywords like racism, discrimination, white privilege. We talk about those things that, oh, hang on, that's not me. I'm not like that. So people become defensive rather than accept it and understand that it's there. And once we know and understand that it's there, we then can understand how to accept it and move on. And there won't be people like me, like in businesses, to advocate for my mob. We just need people to be more accepting of it, to accept that there is a problem out there first. And we've seen it countlessly, time and time and over again, through our great Indigenous athletes in this country. Mm. And we've seen it in research. We've seen it only recently in WA with the outcomes of a court of a police officer being not charged for killing an Indigenous woman. You know, my background is in criminology, so I kind of lean to those types of discussions as well. So it kind of interests me. But that's where the most important thing is, that how do we best challenge these uncomfortable discussions in our work sites and in our workplaces? When we talk about being an anti-racist, what does that mean for people in the business? So you've got to understand what racism is in them first.
Yes.
So it becomes another uncomfortable discussion. And then people start thinking, well, I'm in the business because Indigenous Australians just don't get a chance. We don't. We've never have. To say that I'm an advocate to what? And so to understand that, you need to go back in time to say, well, hang on, this is what's really happened in our past. Australia was created or colonized and invaded on the basis and premises of race ideologies and theories. So for one of our first legislations was the White Australia policy.
Mm.
So it can be that confronting for people. No, we never did that. No, it's never been created. Then we divided the country up based on this Aristotelian system of ownership, control, based on wealth of its citizens. So for all of the 18th and 19th century, we created this power-based class system. And who was that power and class? It was based on what we call it as white privilege.
Mm.
It's kind of an invisible force, you could say, that was recognized that you could actually walk into a shop and you could find your basic necessities, you know, for non-Indigenous people. That's how simple it was. You could turn the TV on and you could see that you were widely represented. It basically means being able to move through your pathway or your journey of life without being racially profiled or unfairly stereotyped.
Mm.
That's basically what it means. But when an Indigenous person comes to an interview, already we have these feelings and connotations of people who are actually creating biases. And there's no harm in creating biases, mind you. I'm not saying it's wrong. But when we do step across that line, then we know then those biases now become racist opinions, and they stop people from actually having a chance. So then you start questioning, well, where's equity? Because all these things have been a matter of cosmetics and inconvenience for a group of people. When we first colonized the country, we built suburbs in places away from areas, away from different races.
Yes.
Put people on missions. We stole children away. We did all these horrid things of domesticating people, of doing what? Of making them look normal. That's really what it was. So to say that we're not impacted by those theoretical propositions back then, we are.
Mm.
That's what I'm advocating for. That's what I advocate today in our work sites, because it still exists. We still have a problem. I wouldn't be in a job if there isn't.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to thank you for sharing your story, particularly your formative years. It's really given us a really great sense of who you are as a person and what's led you to where you are now, but also sharing your perspectives on, you know, a bit about where you think Australia is now. And I want to ask you some questions about that. But I want to go back to your North Queensland experience. I'm a fellow North Queenslander. I grew up in Townsville. It sounds like we're of a similar vintage. And it was always very difficult for me when I, as a later teen, came down to Brisbane and couldn't believe the difference between a regional Australian area and a capital city in terms of people's perspectives, mindset, even just awareness of Indigenous Australians. Do you find that gap between regional Australia and our densely populated cities, that disconnect still exists?
There sure is. And it's, I guess, what I find and what I grew up with is that there was a massive gap living in Mount Isa.
Mm.
I just felt that there was a lot of systemic, institutional, schooling, health, you name it, problems. You know, I was a young second eldest. I had nine in my family. I took some early responsibilities that I didn't want none of my other brothers and sisters to actually go and or have contact with the police, because we all were informed what the police would do to you. We all knew what community services people of taking children away would do to you. So we were always afraid of that stuff and always had charcoal there to rub onto our skins to stop the officials from actually taking us away. So I grew up with those types of mindsets.
And just to clear up for people that may not be aware of that, was that, I think I have a general awareness of that, and that's because in case you were mixed race, they would take lighter kids first. Is that the experience that you had? Yeah.
That's right. You know, back in those days, you were categorized based on color of your skin.
Yeah.
And you know, we were even told in our school when I was at school that you don't sit at the front of the class because we weren't white children. We weren't allowed to sit at the front of the class. And then I wasn't allowed to sit in the back of the class because I wasn't a black child either. So I had to sit to the middle.
Right.
They said that it's never as good as the white fellas, but never is going to be as bad as the black fellas either.
Ah, oh, it's just horrendous, isn't it? And that's this generation.
That's right. That's what I had to face.
Yeah.
I could be very bitter because that's very confronting for anyone. How would a parent like that to hear that for their children today? We're not saying that all non-Indigenous people were part of this process of causing this large divide. We're not saying that. I'm not trying to say that. Dispossession, displacement, the cruel horrors of treatment and discrimination towards Indigenous Australians, and you know, even today, while not all white Australians today participated directly in that mistreatment, their learned biases and their safety from such treatment led many to commit one of those most powerful actions, what I do is advocate against, which is silence. But no one says nothing. No one does nothing to address it. Every recruit is happy to not have an Indigenous person come through. You know, that's the stuff I'm dealing with, is the silence about why people aren't doing something with it. And is that now the greatest mistreatment that we deal with today in our businesses, is that silence? Part of them being an advocate, because I'm the opposite to that. I speak up, not silent, because I'm actually trying to do something to create change. And that's what you talk about when you become an advocate. You actually have to speak up. You have to talk about those issues. And whereas everyone's quite happy to be silent, and you're happy to see that young girl not get the job or not be treated the same way, not get the same wage, not get this equal treatment, but get dismissed, etc., because of the same behavior that someone else did exactly the same. You know, I speak up. And that's, to me, that's the most powerful inaction that people do, is remaining silent.
Yeah. Well, your community and Ventia are very lucky to have you, because it must be tiring having to break that silence. You talked about at a young age having to take on leadership in your family to protect your family members. As you said, it would be so easy to be, you know, really brought down by the types of oppression that has happened in Australia. How did you come through that? I'm sure it's been quite a journey. And the reason I ask is because while it is in this generation and it is horrific, as I said, people could take inspiration from a story from someone like you, Byron.
Yeah, for sure. Look, sports was my outlet.
Right.
I was a fanatical sports person. I wasn't much of a team player, mind you. I played the rugby because all my family played.
Everyone plays, NRL.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just, but I was a big set guy, always in the forwards in the rugby league.
Mm.
I enjoyed boxing. I enjoyed that team morale, but the individual competitiveness, I enjoyed that.
Mm.
And I really took to that pathway and learned about discipline in my life in an early age. I learned about what discipline meant, how it actually could help me. And I literally can say now it actually did.
Right.
Help control temper, help control who I was as a young man growing up in a dusty old Mount Isa. So it really helped me gain a perspective about my abilities, my skills, what I could do. You know, that's the type of things that I was able to think about from that perspective. That I was able to do things. I was able to feel that I was progressing. People recognized my progression through sport. And I kind of loved that, because people would celebrate my success through them. And I thought, oh, well, I must be doing something right here.
Yeah, okay.
I liked that. Wanted more of that, like you could say. And I did it all throughout my teenage years, and just liked that fact of celebration of through my sport. And that's what kind of harnessed me to be disciplined and wanting to give things a go and, you know, even to move out of Mount Isa, it was a major step. But all that earlier preparation disciplined me. I could do it. I am confident. I'm capable, and all those other feelings of moving out of the Isa.
And it sounds like your family, you know, you've come from, as you said, fierce warriors, but it sounds like your mum epitomised that. It sounds like you've had some incredible role models.
Yeah, that is true. And back in those days, we only had the local role models in town.
Mm. We
have these national role models that are everywhere all over the country today.
Yeah, right.
Didn't even know what the word role model meant, to tell you the truth, growing up. So it's kind of like we just look up to your uncles and you look up to your family's close friends, and you go down and watch the local football game, and these guys are phenomenal players. They're phenomenal athletes. And that's how I learned what a role model was, because these guys were aspiring people to actually have those type of skills. So, yeah, that's how I learned what a role model was, through watching and observing how people were and what people could do and how do you get to that stage that they're at. And because I was doing a sport that might made me progress, that was just my general curiosity. I wanted to progress. I wanted to move on and find out how I could make myself better.
Wow, and I do want to talk about your role in Ventia and the work you've been doing. But before we do, I can't get away from your upbringing in Mount Isa, because for those people that are listening that haven't been to Mount Isa, it is pretty much a resources town, you know, a mining town. You know, you look at the skyline of Mount Isa and it's just dominated by mining. And we're really interested in your perspective, having grown up there and then having, you know, different experiences. What is your thoughts or even reflections on the work that the resources and energy industry have done in terms of Indigenous engagement? Have they been doing okay? Obviously, there's more to be done. There's no question about that. But I'd just really like to hear your insight on that.
Yeah, for sure. I happened to sit in a resources meeting in my early years in Mount Isa through my family's Kalkadoon claim.
Mm-hmm.
We sat through a resources meeting where they were going to build this massive pipelines of gas, moving gas along. And some of that pipeline actually edged on into my great-grandfather's country, the Kalkadoon country.
Right.
And so the resources sector were there with their lawyers and their entourage of people to share and explain and be as detailed as possible about the impact, where it was going. We had cultural walkers walking to check the sites out. And the bottom line was, at the end of the day, that was fantastic, that type of engagement. It was. It was really top-notch engagement about allowing the local people where I lived to be engaged in the survey and checking where this site, this pipe was going to be located and laid out, because it was entering into another state. So I was part of that process. It was good to be part of it. I take my hat off for that. But what I found was challenging throughout that process is the set mines. You know, obviously this pipeline meant hundreds and thousands of dollars for this particular resource sector conglomerate, because they had such an invested interest in this in my country.
Right.
So when I say one set mine in our association in Mount Isa, we had to talk through it. We had to do it our way. We had to understand this impact on our mob, how and what benefits and what gains that we could get from it as well. Whereas the resource sector can be very one-minded focus, and that focus could be that you stop forgetting about the interests of the local Indigenous people in that particular case. This is it. This is how it is, and this is what it's going to be. So there wasn't no sharing to say, well, hang on, what about this? What about that? How can you, you know, because obviously when you start putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into a country, you know, if you put it in a pastoralist, he'll expect remuneration. He'll expect recompensation. That's his expectation for a pastoralist. They want that. And when you're going through an Indigenous country, and when you're dealing with a native title, dealing with people who have some epical ancestral connections to that country, where you practice law and continual connections to that country, how do you give back to the local traditional people? How does the resource sector do that? It's not definitely by the way of saying, well, if you don't sign this, we will take you to court.
Mm.
And it's between really wanting to listen and really wanting to invest in a community, or you really wanting to just be this window dressing approach and say, yes, we did it, not we did, but they said no, but we're going to do it anyway.
Right.
So I had those types of experiences. You know, I believe that things have changed a lot. We've got a lot of good barristers out there now and a lot of great people out there that are actually have our interests at heart. I do believe that. I start seeing some changes. It's slow. It is slow. But the resource sector has actually started to learn a lot too on how to do these things better, such as communicate and engage better in the communities and put people on into organisations to kind of validate that, you know, we're there for the long term, not there for a chat and see you later.
Yeah, to steer the process. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's the evolvement that's happened in the resources industry. There's some great examples of positive outcomes from what you've described, but there's also still, even to this day, some really terrible examples. And collectively, glad that you raised those points as fundamentals before we even talk about Indigenous employment, because outside the government, the resource and energy industry is obviously the number one employer in Australia, practically down to where the industry operates. And that does bring me on to your role at Ventia and about the Ventia's Indigenous employment team. Can you tell me about, which is called Tracker, you've mentioned it already. What's your involvement there and, you know, what's the team makeup and what does it do?
Well, we're a large national employer. We've got an extensive network of clients and contractors. We offer kind of scalable and tailored kind of employment programs that are directly linked to jobs.
Yeah.
We provide long-term and short-term casual roles to the most highly disadvantaged group in Australia, Indigenous Australians. We want to look at meaningful employment opportunities that are not just meaningful employment, but also culturally supportive and culturally safe opportunities within the business. So we've kind of got a mission statement that's what kind of our mission is to do. But we do that by a number of things. You know, we do a lot of things within the business. And anything that's a normal recruiting agency does in this country, we totally do something totally different to that.
Right. So
we'll turn the table right around and we'll say, well, have you thought of it from this angle? We'll do it this way. So we'll miss out on interviews. We don't go to the interviews. We'll talk about a group discussion. We'll talk about yarning, okay, circles, about other things that put people in a better culturally safe position to make them feel comfortable coming into the workforce. Any organization is an enormous beast to be part of. For these different tentacles and trying to understand it, so anyone would get a cultural shock coming into any large business like ours. And the Tracker team, made up of myself as deputy project manager, we have a team of Indigenous employment coordinators in different parts of the country. We have an IT communications person also, and we also have a data analysis that supports our attrition and monitors candidates' hours and work to make sure that they're getting full-time work, they're not missing hours, and we can reach out and do welfare checks and do that
right.
Sort of stuff. One of our biggest work tasks is about networking in the Indigenous communities. We're networking Indigenous organisations, networking organisations that work for Indigenous people, and then also networking within our own business, because our contracts are quite large. We're all over Australia, from the resource sector.
Such a diverse business.
Absolutely. And every contract then has hundreds of different workers under those type of, and supervisors and senior managers in those roles as well. So then we need to also create networks with those relationships at the same time. We need to help those contracts feel that they're capable of creating a supportive, diverse workforce with Indigenous Australians, and then also be supported in looking at a diverse Indigenous, some contracted Indigenous businesses as well. Then if they decide to look at an Indigenous workforce, how do you then support that Indigenous workforce? And how do you then look at HR systems that are systemically not created for diverse groups or diversity or Indigenous Australians for that matter? So then you've got those issues to deal with and walk through with the business as well, which the Tracker team provides support to within the business.
How long has it been around for and how's it going?
It's great. Tracker's originated under the IEPI initiative. That's the Indigenous Parity Initiative from the Australian government.
Okay.
So we received a contract from the Prime Minister and Cabinet back in those days to set realistic corporate targets on recruiting for Indigenous Australians over a four-year period. So that was our task. And we did that through, as I said, through a number of ways. And attrition is also part of that component. You know, we don't we don't want to just employ and then forget about them and easy to recruit, but then how do you keep people in the business?
Well, not so easy nowadays, is it?
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and a lot more difficult when you have a place that's not culturally
safe. Yeah.
Wow. So then how do you create a safe environment? You know, what is cultural safety? People, you know, we've got people in the business, we've got people everywhere saying, I still don't know what cultural safety means. Is it just means cultural awareness or what does it mean? Is it just a one-off thing? So there's all those things that we work through and we make it long-term. We don't try to make it just a one-off occasion. So it means an ongoing commitment to the space. And fortunately, Ventia is an Elevate Reconciliation Action Company.
Okay.
And what that means is, you know, on the path of Reconciliation Australia, Ventia has a very high level of championing and pioneering new initiatives for Indigenous Australians to get them into employment within the business. And as a champions, we'll do anything possible. And sometimes we need to have those hard discussions. We need to talk about the narratives of people and the backgrounds. And we need to be flexible in our HR systems. And we need to consciously look at doing things differently to what we have done or what others are doing at the moment. So that's what we bring to the business. And the business is, it has that type of commitment to greater Indigenous participation and inclusion.
Well, I've got a heap of questions and I'm just really enjoying listening and hearing your perspective. Is there anything particularly at your time at Ventia and the Tracker team and the initiatives that you've done, is there anything particularly that you'd look back on and are very proud of the way that it's been done? Is there anything that stands out?
Gosh, there's so many. There is so many. I think the networking and the creating of relationships is such a big one. You know, the creating relationships and creating all those relationships with people and seeing their genuineness to want to see change, that's powerful to see those things occur. There's only one of me, but we've got a massive business. So I kind of like open the gate, bring the people to the business. I need then the investment of the business to take care of most people. And it's then checking on how they're going and checking on how the business is moving with Indigenous people in the business. That's kind of what I'm trying to do, and because it's impossible for me to be a contract manager for every contract and resource sector or every business and then look after the Indigenous workforce.
Yeah.
So I leave it to the business. I leave it to the contract managers, but I'm there to support them to walk through these things. I go through stages in the business as well when I see great success. You know, for instance, a young 18-year-old that's never worked before, has never got into a job, but has been trying for the last 12 months to get into employment, just hasn't had that chance. No one's given them that chance. Then all of a sudden, through our programs, this person has a chance, has an opportunity. Now, that's rewarding.
Mm.
And then you see the contrast to that is a return-to-work mother, you know, has had the last 10 to 15 years working, looking after children, has also the same situation, can't get back into the workforce. Their resume is just half a page. The skills and training they haven't done because they put their life on hold to do and look after children. And then the values are for Indigenous people is that we value our families, we value children, and that's where our values are. We embed it in our families. And most workplaces don't understand that type of, you know, they may understand, say, oh, yeah, families, that's important, yeah. But families, I mean, the impact that we have on our family responsibilities and obligations are very, very, very important for us. And that's there's a lot of difference there. And that's doing that training and education.
Mm.
It's powerful to get those return to work mothers back into the workforce. It's seeing that we're employing a 75-year-old man in a land maintenance contract that works then on land maintenance and who needs to come back to the workforce. You know, we love that. I love those feelings. So that's really... There's powerful messages of, you know, when the contracts actually understand the benefits. What people don't understand is that when you employ an Indigenous person, you're not employing them, you're employing that person's community, and the ripples will be felt throughout that entire family and those communities. Because we talked earlier about role models, talked earlier about, you know, mentors. These are those role models and mentors. That's what our business is creating. We're creating Indigenous Australians who are now going to be those role models and mentors. Don't have to be the most aspiring national athlete. They've got a job.
Yeah.
That's making a massive difference. They've got a job and they're earning income. They're buying a car or they're addressing their milestones, you could say. People don't really understand that. They don't, because they don't see that. All they see is the operator that turns up to work, fixes whatever needs to be fixed, and then they go home.
Yeah.
That's what a manager would see. But for me, networking and connections are important because you want to see the stories behind our mob. You want to hear and see what the impact is, what's happening to the local footy team where that the son's playing from that person who works in your business, what that type of impact is, and then what his goals are. Now he wants to work as an electrician because his father's working with alongside him. Because it's those types of conversations that are happening quietly at home that the business doesn't see. And those impacts are actually quite massive. If you flip it over then and you say, well, I've got this person coming in for an interview and they don't get this job and they don't get it because of unconscious bias, opinions and prejudices of the people that have actually just done the interview. Nothing's wrong with them on paper. They look great. It's just an entry-level role. You don't need to be a brain surgeon for these roles, but they still didn't get the job. So the conversations start changing a little bit at home now.
And
all we have is the recruiter and the managers at the table saying, oh, next, please, and roll them to that stage.
When you were talking about the successes and the elements of your job that is really rewarding, there's always that flip side. And in the spirit of what you started with, which is a lot of your job is having these uncomfortable conversations, apart from what you just pointed out to us in terms of unconscious bias, what are some other things that you think resources and energy employers, but any employers who, you know, have Indigenous employment pathways or have a focus on this area, what are some of the really big things that frustrate you that really need to be worked through?
Yeah. Look, some say reaching a percentage milestone is a great outcome when it's with employment. Don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. It's actually quite valuable. People get to measure it.
Yeah.
Then shows, look, this is what I'm doing. I can show it off to my friends and other businesses. Other things. And, you know, there's things like social corporate responsibility. What does the business actually do to show that they are invested, genuinely invested in the communities or in Indigenous people? What are they? That's one of them. It's one to think about. Then the other one is, you know, Indigenous leadership opportunities in a business to create some cultural systemic changes, real change from the group directors to GMs to directors, brands having a fair go, having the same equal chance as any other person would have. Why don't we have Indigenous CEOs at this moment in our resources sector? Why aren't we training people to take those leadership roles? You know, people will sit in that same role for the next 5 years and 6 years and, you know, never be considered. Is that a bias because they weren't considered? They're the challenging questions that I ask managers. Why didn't you consider so-and-so for that role? Why didn't you think about that person? Because they've been there, they've been loyal, they've been, you know, they've just given you 5 or 7 years of service and we're just leaving them there. It's those types of hard conversations that become quite personal that sometimes people find it very uncomfortable to have those conversations, mind you, about, or maybe their bias needs to be challenged. You know, maybe that's the other thing. Maybe bias challenging training, not just cultural awareness training, but diversity training also. Those type of commitments. Maybe an anti-racism training. What does anti-racism mean? Does it mean being an ally to it? Does it mean being a champion of it? But we can't make everyone do that, but it's just things about acknowledging first. That's the biggest thing I find is that you've got to acknowledge it, that there is a problem. If you don't, no one has that discussion. It's you'll talk about other things in your meeting, you talk about your HSC, you talk about the profit.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden the anti-racism discussions get sidetracked and there's no more discussion. So where there's cultural safety that happen and how do you then create safety in the workplace? And when a culturally inclusive discussion comes up as a result of someone looking at being terminated, we forget about that. We're not talking about it anymore. And people are affected by it. And then people walk away from those organizations saying, well, that particular organization's quite racist. That organization.
Yeah, right.
Because that's the message that it's giving. It's not doesn't want to work with people that were from diversity. When we stop having those discussions, you know, it's important to keep those discussions as livable as we talk about HSC, you know, in our businesses. Our businesses are matured now. We're not in the Stone Ages anymore.
No.
We've matured beyond that. Let's have that diversity discussion now. It's not just putting one black fella on and saying, yes, I've made my targets now. How does that look safe? It's having better discussions about those types of behaviors and talking to people within the business that you've got it, that you want to value.
Gosh, you must be exhausted because it sounds like you spend your whole life educating people. But before you answer that, I do, and I have a left field question for you, but I've also got an anecdote that I thought was just brilliant, but so sad as well. So Ben Wyatt, I'm not sure if you're aware of Ben Wyatt, used to be the treasurer in WA and proud Indigenous man. He's now on the board of Woodside and Rio Tinto, and he was taken to task at some sort of forum. I've only heard about this secondhand, but someone can correct me if I'm wrong. And someone started to question his credentials in the industry, and he said, I've had people tell me my whole life what I can't do. I'm not going to start listening to them now. And the courage that that takes is incredible. And the courage that it takes for you in your job to educate people and constantly be, you know, really working on removing these barriers is really incredible, Byron. And I want to ask you, and feel free to comment on that, but something that bugs me a little bit is that I've seen, you know, most recently in the last few years, that focus on racism and race relations in Australia and the structures and the systems, you know, in our institutions and our systems that support that seem to often get a lot of focus when there's race issues in the US. And it really bugs me that, it doesn't bug me that these things get brought to attention, like Black Lives Matter, et cetera. But it bugs me that we're not doing that ourselves, that it's happening often because there's a focus elsewhere in the world that holds a mirror up to us. What do you think about that?
Yeah, look, it is a changing landscape. There's no doubt about it. And when you start having conversations in the worksite, I think there's not only the uncomfortableness of talking about racism, but just being able to talk to an Indigenous person. People don't know how to do that. That's my experience. People just don't know what to say, what to do with the landscape of the Black Lives Movement within organisations, within businesses.
Mm.
But you're not walking into a dark cave where you can't see. You can see, and it's just been treating people with basic human rights.
Mm.
That's really at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's you know, I'll only say it again, you know, poor brother boy, that's Ben Wyatt. I feel his pain, because none of the black fellas in Australia have ever been questioned, and you know, it's been my life too. You have to keep on
proving yourself.
Proving yourself to who? You know, to why? Why should we do that? To who? You know, and why should I have to prove myself? And when you've done it to everyone else, have you asked everyone else too?
Mm-hmm.
What really is that though? When you really start looking at it, is that racism? Is that a systemic discrimination or social inequality? What is that, you know?
All of the above?
Yeah, that's right. They're real hard questions to ask.
Yeah.
Why are we allowing those behaviours to go unaddressed, you know? That's what I would be worried about. And, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement, for me, I guess I mentioned earlier that poor sister in Geraldton, she was killed by police officer.
Mm.
When you look at the jury, they were all non-Indigenous. So when you look at the process, all of the systems, how do you fight against a system that's not being created for a minority group? And that's at schools, health systems, work sites, recruitment, where systems are being created but never included or have inclusion of an Indigenous people to be part of that solution or be part of that process. So then already you've got social inequality occurring. Now then the systemic discrimination occurs because the system has been created. Now we just haven't addressed it and to look after diverse needs of our people, the diversity in our country.
Mm.
So you wondered why, you know, when you know I was going to school, all the black kids in the back all left. No one stayed behind. Because the system wasn't created for them.
Mm.
Half of my mob in the middle of the classroom started to leave. But the people that stayed were the people at the front. They all remained. No, they didn't go nowhere. Because the system was created for them. That's the uncomfortable truth. That's the reality of what we still deal with today, that systems are still created. And whether it be a HR system within a business, we're not. And when we try to review it to be inclusive, we'll do it with a group of non-Indigenous people. Let's review it and let's fix it up. Okay, well, there's no social inclusion there.
Yeah. Yeah. It keeps fulfilling, that self-fulfilling prophecy just keeps on, you know, repeating it. And I mentioned before, you must be tired. And I want to take you back to what we started with when you told us your ancestry and you told us your family and the very powerful warriors that you've had in your life. And I'm sure they're very proud of the work that you're doing, because I appreciate you spending time with us on this podcast, telling people your story, but also your really important perspective. And thank you in what must be tireless work. Thanks so much for joining us, Byron.
Thank you, Tara. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Resource People Podcast. Byron is truly an inspiration for how Indigenous Australians are such an asset to not only the Ventia team as a role model and mentor, but an absolute asset to our industry and our communities. It was fantastic to hear about Byron's unique and very personal approach to creating positive outcomes for Indigenous Australians and for businesses. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and I look forward to you joining us next time on Resource People Podcast.
AMA acknowledges and pays respects to the traditional custodians of the land from which the Resource People podcast was recorded from today, both the Turrbal and Yugara people. AMA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which you are living, learning and listening to this podcast from today. We pay our respects to elders both past, present and emerging.
Thank you for listening to the Resource People podcast. We look forward to you joining us next time as we highlight the many great stories of the resources and energy industry. If you have any questions about the podcast, please email media@ama.org.au. Produced by Brad Thompson.